Hello, this is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Buddhahood Without Meditation, Part 5.
Yes, Ken?
What do you want tonight?
What do I want?
Yes.
More.
Please, sir, may I have some more? Okay. Yes. Yes.
What is this?
Which is that?
Absolute manifesting absolute reality. Mm-hmm. I read it last night, and it made the other book look simple.
Which other book?
The blue one that was all the blah blah blah. I mean, I read this last night, and it's bizarre. And I wondered if you're going to be speaking to it at some point.
Hadn't planned on it.
You just were going to put it in there for us to find?
I'm glad you found it.
Well, I noticed it because I heard me yelling, giggling uncontrollably that evening, and I peeked over at what she was reading. She was reading.
Oh, Carolyn.
Yes.
Please explain.
Please explain? That's why I was giggling. My mind simply went sprawling.
It's the Genjo Koan. And probably Dogen's most commented on work.
This?
Yeah. And my aim was to, I couldn't find anything comparable from the Theravadan tradition, but you have the faith in the heart or faith in the mind from the Chinese, and you have the Genjo Koan from Japanese, all the other stuff from Dzogchen, Mahamudra sources and things like that. And I thought it would be interesting for you to have exposure to how other traditions talk about the same kind of thing we're doing.
Sometimes it does sort of doesn't make sense, but then sometimes it seems kind of rude, and then suddenly he says something. What? Like, just so crazy.
Flowers scatter in our longing, mm-hmm. and reeds spring up in our loathing. Such as that.
That actually makes sense.
Oh, well, then if you can understand that, then where's the problem?
There's a great deal more than that one sentence.
Well, give me a sentence.
I don't know. Okay, a lot of it is language, of course. Obviously, that's what
of course.
We're talking
and
about.
It may not be the best translation, but the other translations I was having problems with too. So.
And this is one thing that you're not going to retranslate.
Not knowing Japanese, it makes
me nervous. Not knowing Japanese, it's probably not. But for example, he refers to the myriad things, and it seems like it is a special term for what.
All experience.
Dharmata.
No, all experience.
All experience.
Yeah, it's usually translated as the 10,000 things. That's what the Chinese is literally, what the Japanese is literally.
So, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be authenticated by a myriad things.
Substitute enlightened for authenticated.
Is that
I don't, but it's one of the usual translation.
Okay.
Awakened.
To forget yourself is to be awakened by the myriad things. To be awakened by the myriad things is to drop off the mind body of one's self and others. That actually reminds me of what we were talking about last night. You know,
it's suddenly clearer, isn't it?
Well, it's not clear, but it's going too far. So that's why I'm curious about it, because there are things that kind of, they resonate a little bit, but it's just bizarre. So it's
really look, strange. You know about Kala Rinpoche's meeting with Sun Sen?
Epstein's club.
Yeah, I think it is. So it's all set up in Boston for these two great teachers to meet.
I'm sorry, who is he meeting?
Sun Senin, who's a Korean Zen teacher who died not too long ago. Sun Senin whips out an orange and says, "What is this?" The translator translates this to Rinpoche. It was Peter who's translating. And she goes, says something to the translator. Translator and Rinpoche talk back and forth for about 10 minutes, which is an extremely long time in front of an audience. Finally, Peter, translator, turns to the audience and says, "Rinpoche is very confused. Don't they have oranges where he comes from?" This is somewhat better than the meeting between Trungpa and Thich Nhat Hanh. Well, it's a friend of mine who was present at this meeting and actually who helped to set it up. She said they were both at their worst. And she was a student of both of these people. No. Thich Nhat Hanh was at his puritanical worst, and Trungpa was 2 hours late and completely drunk.
So
what does this tell you about being awake? Both of these stories, what does it tell you?
You don't stop being a human.
No.
Gets lost in translation.
Very well put.
Again.
Gets lost in translation. Yes.
So, can I ask about, for example?
I don't guarantee to be able to comment on this.
I know I have no guarantees from you on any matter whatsoever. But I'm controlling. So, the last paragraph on the first page of it, on page 41. Firewood becomes ashes and cannot become firewood again.
Second law of thermodynamics.
Firewood and ashes where I come from. However, you should not think of ashes as the subsequent and firewood as the prior of the same thing. Okay, now I'm lost because that's exactly how I think of them.
Oh, you think in terms of cause and effect, don't you?
Abides in its own state as firewood and has, well, we've had conversations about Genesis and you grind your axe about the word hetu and gyu and how it should be this and shouldn't be that. Okay, acorn and oak, you know? Yeah. I think of an acorn as prior and an oak as subsequent of the same thing.
Yes.
Kind of the same thing. And so, you know, like he's lost me completely. I don't understand the point that he's trying to make, and he hasn't made it yet. Firewood abides in its own state as firewood and has its own prior and subsequent. And And then he says, although it has its own prior and subsequent, it is cut off from prior and subsequent. Ashes are in their own state as ashes and have a prior and subsequent. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after turning to ash, so a person does not return to life again after death. It is the fixed teaching, and then it gets really, really weird. The fixed teaching of the Buddha Dharma, life does not become death, and therefore we call it non-life. It is the fixed sermon of the Buddha that death does not become life, and therefore we call it non-death. Life is situated in one time, and death is situated in one time. For instance, it's like winter and spring. We do not think that winter becomes spring or that spring becomes summer. Well, that's exactly what I'm hearing.
No.
Exactly.
Welcome to Dogen.
Wow, you know? I mean, Zen Kitchen was cool. I liked it.
No, you didn't. Did you read the first part of Zen Kitchen? Because it's all like this.
Well, this is really, really.
Yeah, well, this is Lou Richmond feels that Dogen is, you know, inexcusably pretentious and arrogant. But that's.
I'm sorry, can you say the first?
Lou Richmond is a friend of mine in the Bay Area and a student of Zen Center and very conversant with Dogen. Doesn't like Dogen at all. I think he's very, very arrogant. But you know, it reaches its own taste. So when you read this, what happens? Pardon?
Your mind stops.
Oh.
It's very much like your book. Well, you know, Ken is clear. He's dense, but he's clear.
That's not the book she's referring to.
The arrow. It's the arrow. Right?
Oh, arrow.
Yeah.
It's clear. It's just clear.
There's clear
and then there's clear.
Okay.
But
let your mind stop and rest there.
If my mind stops when I read instructions on how to use a new machine, too. So.
Rest there, too.
Aren't you lucky?
Okay. So far we've answered two questions, haven't we? What am I and what is life? The last two teachings, right? Is this clear, Franca?
I know you came in saying, what do you want tonight? Two different people asked for what they wanted, and now you're going to do what you want. So, that's clear. I feel like the mouse that the cat just played with.
You know why cats play with mice?
Yeah.
It gets the adrenaline of the mice going. And that runs through all of their muscles and makes the meat tender.
It's just the opposite.
No, apparently it sets up a whole bunch of enzymes which breaks down the meat.
Mice must be different from other mammals.
Well, I don't know the physiology.
Anyway, never mind.
This is a tenderizing process.
I'm hungry. Okay. What am I and what is life? Well, there's a third question. We're continuing our discussion of the view. What about the actions I do? What's up with that? Does it matter what I do? Does it not matter what I do? This is another question that most of us have, right? So, The usual answer to this question is what is the famous line? Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Train your own mind as the Buddha's teaching. Right? Now, that's the usual instruction. Do virtue, avoid non-virtue. But we have a problem now. If there's no thing which is me, and experience is just experience, why does it matter what I do? There's nothing for me to be hurt. There's nothing to me to be benefited.
To be
benefited by good karma. Mm. So, what's the diff? It's the next question that comes up. No? Anybody entertain this question?
Could you state that first part again? If there's not me, and
if there's no me, that nothing exists except as experience, then what matter does it? What difference does it make how I act? Well, there are a lot of people who say everything's empty school and go out and have a gay old time, do terrible things to people, saying, well, it's all empty, so it doesn't matter. It's a rather naive understanding. Well, this will may partially answer your question, Donna, but probably not completely. We experience things. Some things we like, some things we don't like. Some things seem to have a beneficial effect, some things seem to have a harmful effect. All of this is a way of experiencing the world that is organized around a sense of self. To be more precise, it's actually organized around a bunch of sets of cells.
Would you say that it's organized around
A bunch of sense of selves, or that senses of self. Yes, like bunches of senses of self. Now, we have the illusion that we are a consistent entity. You know, we do everything for a rational reason and so forth, and it can all be made sense of, and we spend thousands of dollars in therapy making sense of it. Pardon?
Marriage therapy
value. You told me what it's like.
But in many respects, it's more accurate to see that what we call our personality consists of the pretty Darwinian struggle among a bunch of senses of self, all competing for various resources and getting them according to the results that they produce. No, one sense of self makes everything go nice, then we tend to spend more time with it. Then another one gets upset and really throws a tantrum and completely gums up the works. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. I know all these people who rode the ladder to success only to have some really strange part of themselves come out and kaboom. Next thing they knew, they were on the street. Happens all the time. Of course, we're all consistent, rational human beings. So, every one of these senses of self has a distorted way of experiencing the world. And this guy gives rise to what we call the six realms and all of this stuff. And because of that distortion, or those distortions, then how we act is, because it's based on the projections and not on what actually is, how we act introduces imbalances, and thus we get into trying to compensate for these imbalances, and it just turns out to be a big mess. And that's pretty much the state of affairs in a nutshell. Yes, Marcia.
Well, is it because we've been talking about this, you and I, and the question, you know, has come up, what difference does it make?
Yeah. Well, Buddhist ethics comes down to one very simple principle, in my opinion. If you go into a situation or you encounter a situation and you know what the right thing to do is, and maybe it costs you something to do it. Maybe it costs you some money, maybe it costs you some inconvenience, maybe it cost you your job or a friendship. But you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards?
Not at all.
Well, if it's a big thing, you may think about it a bit afterwards. But
you don't go around.
Sure.
Obsessing over it.
What if you don't do it? Then you do start obsessing about it, you know, for like 3 or 4 millennia or something like that. You know. So, yes?
I have a question.
Fire away.
Can you act and you do the right thing, but it really is cutting through a pattern, and so you still have trouble with it because the pattern doesn't like what you did?
Yeah.
And but it's so you can obsess about it also, even though it was the right thing to do.
Understand, but if you take a closer look at that situation, you know what the right thing to do is. It's different from what you've usually done in that situation. You do it. And you experience something which you didn't experience before. Something which you have avoided experiencing for a very, very long time. Right? So that's a little bit of a shock to the system. Right? It's like throwing a stone into a pond that ripples out. And that's what you're experiencing. Are the ripples of the shock. Mm-hmm. When you act in that situation and you are clear, I'm going to put that in a safe condition, do you question afterwards whether you did the right thing or not?
No.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah, there may be ripples and turbulence and things like that. But you acted in accord with things.
I don't know if I even agree with that, actually. Because I've seen it in myself and I know I've done the right thing, but I have another pattern, which is to go over and over and over the situation whether I did the right thing or not.
Yeah.
But that's also a pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is preventing, it has developed to dissipate attention so that you don't experience something else.
It is a big mess.
It is a big mess. And the patterns are interconnected and all kinds of stuff. So, anyway, returning. Basis of Buddhist ethics is that. In other words, basis of Buddhist ethics is simply what leaves your mind at peace.
What was that?
The basis of Buddhist ethics is simply what leaves your mind or you at peace. Now, from the perspective of direct awareness, Dzogchen, Mahamudra, whatever you want to call it, is there anything which can be harmed by... Is there anything which can be harmed? Is there anything which can be benefited? Now we have to keep in mind Yogi Berra's injunction here. In theory, there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is. Because we don't have the capacity to experience whatever arises, then we experience things affecting us.
We experience things how?
Affecting us.
Because we have reacted to what has arisen?
Well, you can put it in terms of reaction, or we can put it in terms of there's a sense of self which can categorizes experience into what supports or threatens or is indifferent. If we go to Buddhist enlightenment, what Buddha did on that full moon night, Bodhgaya, 2500 years ago, was reach a level of attention in which you could experience whatever arose. This now goes by the very fancy name of Vajra-like samadhi. But it simply means one can experience whatever arises in experience. So just take that in for a moment. What would your life look like if you were able to do that? Franca?
My house would be very messy.
Would it?
Other people would mess it up. I wouldn't be doing anything, so
is that true?
Ask the question again, please.
What would your life be like if you could experience whatever arrives in your experience? Just experience it completely. Well, number one, would you have any enemies?
Would you have any
enemies?
Enemies. Why not, Karma?
You wouldn't have any enemies because there would be no block between what came and what you were left with. So there would be no remaining.
Yeah.
And yeah. Time doesn't function, so you're not holding on to junk.
Yeah. The only reason we experience somebody as an enemy is because interaction with them elicit something we don't want to experience.
On the other hand, though, you wouldn't experience them as an enemy, but that doesn't mean, because others may not be able to experience everything that arises, and so you may still have enemies. And I seem to remember Stephen Batchelor talking about the life of the Buddha, someone trying to assassinate the Buddha.
Yes. Well, this takes us to a very important story about the man who thought he was a kernel of corn.
Kernel of?
Corn.
Oh, okay.
Better than the bear story.
Bear story is a good story. So there's this guy.
Corny.
Yeah, we'll call him Bob. He thinks he's a kernel of corn, and everybody in the world is a chicken. Needless to say, he ends up in the mental health institution. Extreme paranoia. He works with this doctor for many, many years, psychiatrist. And he comes to understand that he's not a kernel of corn. Psychiatrist says, you know, this is really good. Great. You've been here on these grounds for many, many years. Would you like to, maybe tomorrow we go out and take a look at the city? Bob said, you know, I'd like that. That'd be great. So the next morning, Bob and the psychiatrist go out the gates of the grounds of the mental health institution. And across the street, there are a bunch of people lined up waiting for a bus. And Bob takes one look at them, takes off. He goes so fast, the psychiatrist has no idea where he's gone. He calls the police, and late that night, they find Bob cowering in some drainage culvert in another part of the city. And they bring him back to the mental health institution, clean him up, put him to bed. Next day, Bob comes into the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, Bob, I don't get it. You know you're not a kernel of corn. What happened yesterday? Look, Doc, I know I'm not a kernel of corn. You know I'm not a kernel. But those damn chickens out there, they don't know. So as you say, just because you have no enemies doesn't mean somebody won't regard you as a good enemy. Okay, but that's one thing that would be different. What else would be different if you could experience whatever arose? Anita.
You wouldn't be spending a lot of time in your head.
Say more.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it would require a whole lot of thought.
Why not?
Because if you can really experience what arises, I think things would be clearer.
Mm-hmm. There's a line in the Heart Sutra about this, isn't there?
Plus, you wouldn't need to be, obsessing about the past and the future.
Yeah, that's true. Because for bodhisattvas, there is no clouding in mind, they have no fear. Okay? So, the whole world changes when you can experience things completely. There's another little one. If you're an emotion, what do you want?
Attention.
Go a little bit further.
I want to be felt.
You want to be felt. Feelings arise to be felt. What happens when you don't experience a feeling that arises?
They take other forms.
They keep knocking at the door, don't they? And if you push them into the body, then they manifest in the body and eventually you get cancer or something like that. They keep calling for attention. What if you do experience a feeling? What happens then?
It goes away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's done. It's fulfilled. It's reason for being. So you could think of feeling feelings as an act of generosity. In fact, this is exactly what the burnt offering that we do every morning is about. All of those karmic debts and things like that are basically feelings that haven't been felt, and they keep coming, creating disturbances in our lives, in our practice, etc. And what we imagine in the fire offering is offering them everything wonderful and beautiful so that they get exactly what they want, i.e., they get to be felt. And they're done. So, what would it be like, what would life be like if you could experience everything?
Profound equanimity.
Yeah, extraordinarily profound equanimity. Yeah. What else? Yes?
Well, I just keep thinking that you feel a lot more pain. and my little experience of it, I also feel more compassionate.
You would see the pain clearly?
Sorry?
You would see the pain clearly?
Yes.
Yeah, and the results of the pain? And compassion would arise.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
You wouldn't experience things through labels.
Right. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to make distinctions?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you have equanimity, you have distinctions. Things arise clearly. Right? Very clearly. No clouding. But you know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
You could have planned.
Because there's no separation from the situation. Mm-hmm. Situation tells you what the next action is. Correct. So what I've just summarized there are actually the four pristine awarenesses. Or timeless awarenesses, if you use Chukyi's things. Equanimity is evenness or balance, pristine awareness. Distinguishing is distinguishing, being able to discern differences is distinguishing, pristine awareness. Things arising clearly like reflections in a mirror. It's mirror-like pristine awareness, and knowing what to do is effective pristine awareness. Totality
is
pristine.
The traditional name for pristine awareness wisdom?
They're also called the five wisdoms. Pristine awareness is one translation, timeless awareness is another. I prefer to use, reserve wisdom for another word in Sanskrit, prajna. And the Sanskrit word for pristine awareness is jnana. But you'll see a lot of contexts that will be translated as wisdom, yes.
Did you say the five wisdoms with the four something?
No, the four, and then the fifth one is totality.
So what are the four? Sorry, I didn't catch the grouping name.
Did I say the four something?
The four wisdoms?
Yeah, four aspects of
it. Or pristine awarenesses.
There are five pristine awarenesses. I didn't mean to imply there's a group of four. But you'll sometimes see the four of them grouped together. Okay. So, when we sit and do nothing, we are introducing a different dynamic into the evolution of our experience. What's the first thing you experience when you sit and do nothing? You have various names for it, chaos, mess, etc. I'm going to suggest that the first thing you experience is the Darwinian struggle among all those different senses of self. What's very interesting is when you sit and do nothing, you aren't participating in the struggle. What does that mean?
You see it more clearly.
You see it more clearly. What does it mean for the struggle?
To react.
It's suspended.
Pardon?
It's suspended.
Well, I wouldn't say it's suspended.
Well, you're seeing it. I mean, you're not doing it.
You're not doing it, yes. But the struggle still goes on.
Mm-hmm. But it's getting your attention.
Go on.
When you were talking about how if you feel a feeling, it releases or it's completed. Well, if you are not participating in the struggle, you're actually experiencing the struggle taking place without taking sides, basically.
Yes.
And all of those parts are getting attention at the same time.
Maybe not all at the same time, because we don't have that capacity quite, but...
Wow.
So what's the effect on the struggle?
De-energizes it.
Pardon?
De-energizes it.
Well, you could say de-energizes it, but I think it may be a more helpful way of looking at it. It's not actually de-energizing. As Carol was saying, there's kind of energy going into it, but in a different way. What's your experience?
It's a little bit like somebody fighting but can't find an opponent. It's like...
Mm-hmm.
Struggle, there's nothing there to engage it or something
yeah.
like that.
Let's
fight with each other.
They can do that, yeah. Both are possible.
But it needs you there.
Well, it needs me to believe it. That's the thing, is that the belief gets a little bit shaken by watching it. Just being there with it and not
also can
running off of it.
We can see what we're doing to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Which often is harder when we're acting out. Know.
There's more space.
There's more space. So what happens to the struggle?
It relaxes a bit. You want the real life? It goes crazy!
For a while.
For a while.
And then?
Then it catches me. And I go off. And I go crazy for a while.
Yes.
And come back.
And then?
Well, this has been going on for 49 years, Ken.
No,
when
it hasn't.
I'm 89, I'll give you a call and let you know.
No, no, this dynamic of sitting and doing nothing has not been going on for 49 years. No. Yes. But here you've had 3 or 4 days now of doing nothing. What's your experience? A lot of you have come in and told me something about your experience, so what is it?
My experience is that it kind of loses organization and I get a big shot of energy. And if I don't go herring off into the next set of patterns. There's an experience of clarity.
Yeah.
Sometimes of peace,
mm-hmm.
sometimes of bliss, different things.
Anybody?
Or strong emotions.
Anybody relate to this? Nava?
I just want to add a little bit some kind of newness in newness in possibilities and
yeah, you see all kinds of new possibilities,
right?
That
we're not talking before.
But the struggle basically plays itself out. Unless, of course, we get caught by taking sides and then the whole thing starts up again. So
can I ask a question there? So you don't have to experience each one of those fully and go through the whole, or?
Oh, I think you end up doing that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
No, well, no escape. But it plays itself out. And we find ourselves just resting there. And as Franca pointed out, all of the energy that is being dissipated in the struggle becomes available for attention. So as I say, one's introduced to a different evolutionary dynamic into the system by doing this. Hence the importance of intention. That's what keeps it going. You know?
Did you say intention or?
Intention. Intention. Yeah. Okay. Sit. And do nothing. Now, many of you will have heard the story of the monk who is sitting in the courtyard meditating, and the abbot comes up and says, well, what are you doing? I'm meditating to reach enlightenment. And the abbot sits down beside him, meditation posture, picks up a stone from the courtyard, starts rubbing it with his cloth. The monk continues to meditate. The abbot rubs the stone. Half an hour goes by. An hour goes by. The monk's still meditating. The abbot's still rubbing the stone with the cloth. Eventually the monk can't stand it anymore. What are you doing rubbing that stone with the cloth? I'm making a glass tile, says the abbot. You can't make a glass tile by rubbing a stone. Nor can you wake up by meditating, says the abbot. In other words, as long as you're working at something, you've taken sides. How's that, Anita?
Well, I was thinking about that today.
Say more.
I thought that it would be, this practice would be easier if I had amnesia every time.
Explain that a little more fully, just in case
anybody.
Well,
you know, when I am able to be present to the experience, and you know, I want to do that again. Well, you know, if I reach a state of peacefulness with that.
Right. So what prevents you?
Trying.
Where does the amnesia come in?
Well, if I could kind of forget, if I could just be present and not be thinking about where I want to get.
Oh. Would this come under the rubric hope?
More like striving.
Oh, striving. Okay.
Efforting, yep. And all those things that aren't resting.
So why do you do that? Pardon?
It's automatic.
No. Try again.
Why do I do it?
Yeah.
Because I have preferences.
Much better answer. So what are you going to do? There's a teaching from the mind training tradition on that. Which unfortunately I don't have the book here, so I won't be able to remember it. But it goes something like, when my mind is all disturbed and agitated and going crazy, that isn't in the translation, but it's the sense, there's no better place to be than this mat. This present state is just fine. I'm not being burnt in hell. Great. I'm not being roasted and scalded. Great. Or, even more to the point, this is a wonderful little prayer. This is for people who, intended for people who are ill. If it would be better for me to get better, may I get better. If it would be better for me to stay ill, may I stay ill. Better for me to die, may I die. Many years ago, I was working with a woman who had terminal cancer, and it was just a matter of time. And we went through a bunch of stuff, and then one day she said, can you give me a prayer to work with? So I said, well, yeah, here's this prayer. And she went, what? Are you nuts? I said, well, you asked me for a prayer, here it is. I don't want that prayer. Take that damn prayer. I don't want to ever hear about that prayer. Okay, fine. Came back 2 weeks later to see her. Because I saw her at home. Remember that prayer you said last time? Yeah. I can't get it out of my head. And in an odd way, it's very comforting. Contrell describes his prayer as one which dissolves hope and fear. So you're absolutely right. Preferences. Want to experience this? Don't want to experience that, right? What do you do?
Often, just being okay with what was going on.
Go further.
I've been seeing that it doesn't matter.
Why not? Why doesn't it matter?
Well, if the preference is all about this practice, and those particular preferences don't get me to this, my preferred place, but they have the opposite effect, then give it up.
So you can get to your preferred state?
No. I could go that far, but I haven't been going that far. I've just been seeing the loop.
Good.
So that helps me let go of it.
Yeah. A friend of mine puts it, we're in a box. To deny the existence of the box is to be in the box. To ignore the box is to be in the box. To try to dismantle the box is to be in the box. To try to get out of the box is to be in the box. What can you do?
Be in the box.
Exactly. That's it.
More specifically, experience the box.
Okay.
So much for chapter whatever it is.
Chapter?
Dismantling the emotions.
It's how you do it.
Dismantling the box?
No. Experiencing the box. goes back to what I was saying earlier.
In order to dismantle the box.
Ah, you raise a very important point. In being in the box, Eugene, what's the intention?
To not want to be somewhere else.
Yeah. Because if you approach it with, I'm going to experience the box so I can be free of the box, guess what? You're in the box.
If you don't examine the box or experience the box not to want to be somewhere else, you experience the box because you're curious about the box. You're willing to know the box.
Yes, it's what you're experiencing right now.
Yeah, but it still has this flavor of avoiding if you're doing it.
Exactly, that's right. And this is the conundrum of this kind of practice. It's very easy to start to approach this kind of practice with the expectation of a certain kind of result. But once that expectation is in there, you can no longer be in the actual experience.
The only way I have ever found to work with myself with these things that are so painful is to be curious. That's the only way.
Okay, and that's a very good way.
Is to be
curious. Okay. Yeah. This is what Stephen Batchelor says about the First Noble Truth. The appropriate response to the First Noble Truth, which is there is struggle or there is suffering, is to get curious about it. Oh, that's strange. So all of this is part of the view. We have to let go and let go and let go. And it's far from easy because we have these deeply instilled notions that this is good for me, that's bad for me. And out of those deeply instilled notions, we seek to control our experience.
But there's an aspect of letting go that could be interpreted as doing something, you know, trying to let it go.
Yes.
And so I've heard the definition of letting go, or I read it in Cornfield's book, that it could mean let it be.
Yeah, that's actually from Joseph Goldstein's book.
Goldstein.
Yeah. And I think it's a very, very good instruction. When we say that we're going to let something go, it means we're just going to let it be there and experience it. We're not going to try and do anything with it. Okay.
When are you going to circle back to the what's the point thing? There's a question. What's the point? Why do anything if there's no me, there's no stuff? What about my actions?
Why are you here? And it's not my magnetic personality, I know that.
I'm drawn here. I mean, I can make up all kinds of rational reasons for being here, but they're not why I'm here. I'm drawn here because of the experiences that I've had here and with you, in retreat with you, and with some other people in this room that I know, some I don't know all of you, but
Those of you that I know. And I'm drawn here because of the certainty of the knowing that I've experienced. Oh, and even when you said earlier about the preferred state, one of the things that I find has occurred to me and has been helpful is Ken's doobie, the silence thing. He bangs the thing and then says, "Where's the silence?" And then whatever you say, he just keeps banging it. Silence for him. Well, that's what it is. The preferred state, to give it a name. It's always there. So, there's no problem. And so, I have known that here, or among these people, with you, etc. So these elements draw me.
So I guess that answers the question, what's the point? You're drawn to a set of conditions which increases your ability to let things just be.
You said, you talked about actions at the very at the beginning. And messy house and so forth. And just what occurred to me, Carolyn and I had the wonderful opportunity just before we came here to play with the 10-day-old baby. And most people, I know it's not true of all people, but most people cannot hold a 10-day-old baby and ask what's the point. It's not possible. Not possible.
Okay.
So that's what occurred to me when you introduced the subject at the beginning.
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't thinking of 10-year-old babies, 10-day-old babies, or 10-year-old ones.
No, well, it's actually a little easier to ask about the point than the 10-year-old.
I just want you to know, with the 10-day-old baby, that Frank kept posing it.
He could just put his little arms and legs anywhere. He was just like,
what I was referring to is what people often do with this fear. It's okay, there's no self, it's all just experience. It doesn't matter what I do. The fact is, it does. It matters a great deal. Because, not because of building up stores of bad karma or big accounts of merit. Buddhahood without meditation talks about, okay, so where's that bad karma stored? Where does it actually exist? It goes through the same kind of examination that we did the last couple of days. Because all of that's a form of projection. And that's why I came down, posed the principle that Buddhist ethics comes down simply to what leaves the mind at peace. And thus creating the conditions to experience things as they are. And that's why what we do matters. Because with everything that we say or do or even think, we set in process or set in motion processes that can be disturbing or activating or unbalancing. And if we do, then we get caught up in the usual mess of trying to compensate and balance and keep everything going, which is how we live most of our lives. And this possibility of just experiencing things as they arise opens up new possibilities. And then we want to lead to one more point. Most of our interactions with life we seek to minimize pain. Why do we do that?
We don't want to experience it.
Yeah. What are we protecting?
No pain.
Yeah, we're protecting ourselves from pain. Very different to live awake. Imagine a situation, some difficulty, say, with a friend. Or maybe some difficulty with someone who isn't much of a friend. And imagine interacting in that situation in a way to minimize pain. So, what does that feel like? How many of you are busy strategizing right now? Okay. Take the same situation.
Well, you're resisting pain,
right? Mm-hmm. Same situation. And be awake in it. And be prepared to act in that wakefulness. What's that like? How much strategizing is there going on?
Well, it seems like you'd be willing to accept the pain, but I was going to ask a question about, well, what's the difference between that and masochism, you know?
Ah, big difference. Masochist enjoys the pain. It's quite unbalanced. You come into the situation, you act. There is pain, yes. But you don't engage the pain to enjoy it. You engage it for another reason. For what other reason?
Because it's there.
Yeah, it's unavoidable.
So does that mean you let it in, you accept it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What?
You don't really have a choice.
Well, a lot of people try to avoid it.
But if you sit still long enough to watch what actually happens, it just means it takes a lot longer to
mean. Oh, you're quite right. Postponing inevitable pain increases it. One of the more dramatic experiences I had with this was a woman in a group I had in Orange County. And one night, she told me that she wanted to talk to me about her son who was a drug addict. And in the same group I had a forensic psychologist, so I asked her to stay, who's very, very well acquainted with drug issues and the legal aspects related to them. So I asked her to stay on. And so this woman explained the situation she was in. Her son was a drug addict, and to support his habit, he was beginning to deal. He's in his early 20s, and she knew, because she knew her son, that he wasn't really clever enough to be a good dealer. So he knew that he would eventually be arrested as a dealer, which carries, of course, much more severe penalties than being arrested as a drug user. And he refused treatment, etc., etc. So she'd all tried all of that stuff already. And she had consulted with people in the system, and they said, well, one of the things you can do is to have him have it arranged for him to be arrested for possession, and then when he's in the system, he will actually get the drug treatment. This is a hell of a choice for a mother. Do you arrange to have your son arrested so that he'll get the drug treatment he needs, or do you wait and let him live his own life so he gets arrested as a dealer and he's in jail for 5-10 times as long? So we talked with her, and at one point she said, I'm just trying to find a good solution. And at that point I said to her, there is no good solution here. There isn't a good solution. You have choices to make, but there isn't a good solution. And my other student, who was the forensic psychologist, backed me up with that. No, this is a bad situation. There is no good solution. And in just hearing that, this goes to your point about letting go. She just could let that be. That's how it was. And then there's the shift in her. And she said, I know what to do. She never told me what she was going to do. I don't know to this day what she did. But she moved into that clarity. So it's very, very much that being awake means we meet what is there and we don't try to minimize pain, which is exactly what she was trying to do. We meet what is there and that's it. It's a different way of living. It involves quite often taking hits. However, it does have one important benefit. Your mind will be at peace, which is actually why you're here and why you're doing this practice. We can't predict what situations are going to arise. We can't predict what we will do in them. I was working with a woman who was dying of AIDS, and she said, what would you be doing in my condition? And I said to her, I have no idea. I said, there are things I would hope I would be doing, but how I would actually be in your position, I have no idea. And that was the truth. And I don't think we can know until those situations arise. We think, we can strategize, we can speculate, etc. This practice is about living free of the projections of thought and emotion. What we're doing in our formal practice, so to speak, is opening to the experience of things inside and out. And not engaging to the extent of our abilities the projections of thought and emotion. So in one sense it's an extraordinary simple practice. In another sense, it's a very, very difficult practice because it's unlike anything we've ever done in our lives before. And this is why one of the ways that this practice is approached is through refining the view, getting clear about, okay, I'm not what I think I am. Things are not what I think they are. The way actions work is not how I think, ordinarily think that they work. And each of these questions that we're dealing with over these evenings opens up a different way of approaching this experience that we call life. Okay? Questions?
Somewhere along the line, I made the association that the reason this type of ethical behavior keeps our mind calm is because it keeps us, for lack of a better word, aligned or in tune with our Buddha nature, whatever that is. Is that true? And if so, what is Buddha nature?
Good job, Art.
Well, if you ask this in the Zen monastery, no one answer you'd get.
Yeah. Okay. But I think we're in a Zen monastery.
I can pretend. My favorite way of regarding Buddha nature is something I read in a Q&A session with Jonathan Controll. There's actually a little book saying Q&A with Controll. We've been asked all these questions and somebody been there writing down the questions and replies. And one of them, what is Buddha? It says in the text that Buddha nature pervades all sentient beings. What does this mean? That was the question. And Contra said, well, the first thing it doesn't mean is that there's a thing called Buddha nature which pervades everything.
It doesn't.
It does not mean that. And then he said, Buddha nature is what remains when all the confusion of samsaric experience is cleared away. So, Art, I have a question for you.
Yes.
What remains when all the confusion of samsaric experience is cleared away?
I don't know.
Do you want to clear away all the confusion of samsaric experience?
Sure.
What remains? Very well said. Approaching this is saying because it keeps it aligned with Buddha nature. It's an extra layer of complication. No. In your experience, what is Buddha nature? Just right in our little exchange there. What was there?
Nothing. I mean, it was
nothing?
Well, not nothing, but I mean...
Not nothing!
It wasn't a request, it was a
question. They're going to be so compassionate, they're going to leave you completely alone in this. So, nothing, not nothing. Say more. I have a very big stick right now.
Mm-hmm.
I keep wanting to go back to that idea of the space in the room, where there's, you know, it's.
You're trying to understand.
I'm not trying to understand it. I'm just trying to explain.
He's not going
to
help.
No, small. I'm trying to explain it. I'm not trying to understand. I can't describe it. I mean, it's.
How do you know what to do in a situation? Let me qualify that.
Okay.
How do you know what to do in a situation if you don't think about it at all?
It's when I don't react. It's when I respond naturally. It's
yes.
This, yeah.
Okay. Where does that come from?
Well, the part of me that wants to get out of hot seats is Buddha nature. But
yeah, no, that's going to fit right in the hot seat.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So where does it come from? Okay. Can you rest there?
At times.
Good. Do so. There's something you can experience and you can't put into words.
Yes.
Rest right there. Yeah, like that. Okay?
Thanks.
Good. What time is it? Okay. Let's take a poll. Yeah, one question, and I have one more piece to add here. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Going back, way back in your earlier comments about what we're doing here is to rest, and not with effort or not trying to be someplace, but it seems to me that if we want to have attention, that you have to bring it back, you know, in a quiet way, not forcefully, but.
Yeah.
We need to bring it back, don't we?
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of ways to approach this. One of the old Tibetan phrases is Drimji Trimla Hlutchi Lu. Drim is the word to firm. Lu is the word to relax. So, you make an effort to move into attention, and then you relax. Another way, if you take the primary practice, mm-hmm. there's a certain effort involved in opening to all sensory experience. There's a continuation of that effort. And opening to all the internal material. When you open your heart, you're actually just opening. And you ride. Then it all falls apart, you go through the same process. So, when it comes to building capacity, we do those things. When it comes to Dzogchen itself, you just sit down and you forget everything you knew about meditation. And you just do nothing. Okay. One other piece I wanted to.
But you can still be attentive, right? Even when you do that.
You're awake. What do you mean by being attentive?
Awake. Aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's still going on. Are you doing something when you're doing that?
Well, slightly. It seems like. Well, it's when you go off.
That's right.
Then you have to do something to bring yourself back, don't you? Or you just kind of, I mean, some things, you suddenly come back like a sound.
Okay.
And it brings you back.
No. Something brings you back, right?
Yeah, similarly, like that.
The moment you recognize that, you're back. You don't have to do anything. The coming back is not something that you do by an effort, is it?
Well, they were both ways, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess you don't have to.
A thought takes you off. Something takes you off.
Yeah.
Do you decide to come back?
No, actually, you're right. Suddenly you're back, yeah.
Suddenly
you're back.
Yeah.
And
now you're just there. You don't get to do any of it. Saraha, in the song of Mahamudra, gives many, many metaphors. One of them is a bird flying away from a ship in the middle of the ocean. It flies and flies and flies. It can go anywhere it wants, but it has to come back to the ship because there's nowhere else for it to land. So our thoughts go off. They have to come back to mind because they are mind. There's many worlds for them to come back. So there's always, we always come back. But it's not something we decide to do. It happens. Then we don't do anything. Carol.
Then, this is a hard question to ask. Then why, when I'll have to use my own ridiculous words, there is a boiling, something is disturbing the peace, and it's not a thought yet. If I look at it, if I notice it right then, and I attend to it, it doesn't become a thought. Why?
Because the energy that's going into the boiling goes into the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how you do the one form of Mahamudra practice is you look at what arises. And it goes poof. Want another approach? Be the boiling.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Yeah, that's about right. Thank you.
Energy.
Don't think about it. Don't understand it. Just do it. You see, Carolyn, I've come before. All the answers are in here. Page 40. We'll go through this later. Carolyn's getting a little ahead of us here. Page 40, stanza 3. Would you like to read it?
Whenever conceptual thinking arises, don't look at what arises. Be what knows the arising. Like an oak stake in hard ground, stand firm in awareness that knows, and go deep into the mystery. I'm really glad you're translating, even from your own translation. Because I don't get what you just had me do and experience from reading this.
What's the relationship between the boiling and knowing the boiling? Two different things in contact with each other?
All I can say is from my experience of the other thing, the noticing it, and...
Yes, that's where you're separating. I ask, what's the difference between the boiling and knowing the boiling?
Well,
just a second.
Another book.
Or if you prefer.
Exactly.
Exactly.
There can't be a difference.
Exactly. Be one. You're still trying to figure it out. It's okay. We're going to take a break. I'll save the last bit for tomorrow.
I have a last question.
Please.
Do we not do this quite naturally somewhat often during the day without really noticing it?
All the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my point is only that we're laboring here over definitions and understanding it, but I think it happens all the time.
You're quite right. It happens all the time. Well, it happens frequently.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen all the time.
No, but I mean...
Yes. Yeah. That, and you're quite right. It makes a difference when... It's the times when it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm.
You know, I went for a walk today and I did, you know, this and that. I went on the swing and I had fun. And really, I think I was having a lot of those moments, and I eventually realized that I, because it's not in the room and I'm not, you know, doing the work, and I just don't, I don't, I didn't sort of put it in this,
yeah.
You know, I didn't sort of equate it to this, but in fact it was.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I've said when things are getting heavy and you're efforting, pushing the practice on like that, stop. Go out, refresh body and mind. So that's the right thing to do. Okay, take a short break.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.